Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. Whether it's helping a single mom in Dundalk keep her home or giving a bright student in Sandtown a chance to be his best, United Way fights for families. Help them win the fight. Visit uwcm.org/fight.
From the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rodericks, Sun columnist, and this is Roughly Speaking for April 1st, 2019.
How does a bastard orphan, son of a whore and a Scotsman.
The Uber musical Hamilton comes to Baltimore's Hippodrome Theater in June. And today on the show, a bit of Maryland history related to Alexander Hamilton, founder of the nation's financial system. Did you know that a case based in Baltimore in 1819 used Hamilton's argument about the implied powers of the Constitution to broadly define the national government's supremacy over the states as a cornerstone of U.S. law? The case was McCulloch versus Maryland. Our guest is Kathleen Day, a longtime journalist, now on the faculty of the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School, where she lectures about the country's banking system and our history of financial crises. In fact, she's written a book about it called Broken Bargain, Bankers, Bailouts, and the Struggle to Tame Wall Street.
There are a ton of great books on every one of the crises that I describe in this book, but it's too much to just have to read all those for many people. I couldn't find one book that in plain English described from the beginning of the country till now the history of banking, which is really tied together, and it has always been a central political issue for us. That's another thing I learned, how contentious it's been always. Finally, I just said, I'm going to write a book.
It's a very good narrative.
I really appreciate you saying
that.
Because this.
No, I'm thinking the value
I've
of this
I poured my
book,
heart into this book and 30 years of reporting.
Yeah. No, I appreciate getting your description of your own book, but I understood that's what it was.
It was eye-opening to me to read Hamilton's argument mm-hmm. to Washington about why was Jefferson wrong and why should you allow the federal government to create corporations.
Alexander Hamilton.
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things I haven't done. But just you wait, just you.
Implied powers.
That is where he made the argument.
Yeah.
That is where he made the argument. And it was used in a famous case in Baltimore that really forevermore has governed the interpretation of the Constitution, was over banking and whether state banks could tax the federally chartered central bank out of to keep it from coming into Baltimore and competing against them. And that case, the government won, and it established that the states can't tax the federal government and keep them out. And the person who argued it invoked Hamilton's
implied powers.
This is in Baltimore.
The case ended up in the U.S. Supreme Court, which, in an opinion written by Chief Justice John Marshall, ruled that the Second Bank of the United States was indeed constitutional, and Maryland's tax was not. In arguing for the legitimacy of the National Bank, famed statesman and lawyer Daniel Webster quoted directly from the implied powers argument that Hamilton had given to Washington in 1791. By agreeing with Hamilton, Marshall broadly enshrined the first U.S. Treasury Secretary's interpretation of the Constitution and established that states could not tax the federal government or otherwise interfere in legitimate federal activities. I'm quoting there from Kathleen Day's book, Broken Bargain.
What's the bargain and why is it broken?
Okay, the bargain in this actually begins all the way back to Jefferson and
Alexander Hamilton.
And I actually saw the show with the original cast. One of the things I learned so much in writing this book is that the fight between Hamilton and Jefferson wasn't just about banking, it was about corporations. The word corporation and bank don't appear in the Constitution because they were too divisive, and the founding fathers thought that it wouldn't get ratified. So one of the bargains, one of the things that Hamilton understood, to have a central bank, it would be incorporated by the federal government. And that's what made Jefferson frightened, because the Central Bank of England was an incorporation, and Jefferson is saying, oh, that's kings and queens. We don't like that. We just fought a war. But the bargain is, and this is what Hamilton understood, is we needed the central bank. And Jefferson really understood banking. That's a misconception that he didn't. He understood it. He just thought it was too dangerous. Hamilton also understood the dangers of banking. So one of the things that he was really clear on when he made his argument to George Washington about why we need this, he said corporations can be dangerous, but they have these benefits. So he understood that being incorporated was a gift that you get from a government. Only governments can create corporations and give shareholders limited liability. In exchange for that, it's not just that they have a right, they have a duty to go in and make sure that that corporation is not doing something that's against the public interest. And so early Americans had corporations that had limited time span and limited purpose. So you could incorporate, you get a corporation for 20 years to build a canal or a waterworks or whatever. And so the first two central banks of the United States had 20-year lifespans. They had to be renewed. So what I learned in this book is that it's bankers and financiers that over our 240, whatever we're up to now in our history, they have shaped the corporate form that we have exported around the world. The fact that corporations now can do whatever they want, basically, they don't have to get permission if they change from making widgets to cars. They live in perpetuity. And they have this almost glorified status. So that's the first bargain. And then as you move through for commercial banks and you get the Federal Reserve Board, and especially FDIC insurance, that is, again, a gift from the people. And government has a right to make sure that if you're a bank, you're incorporated, and you have deposit insurance. Those are gifts. And the government has a duty to go in and make sure that they're not being abused.
Well, that's the part of the bargain that I got from your book so far, from my reading of it, is that for the consumer, for the financial consumer, our bargain is you'll insure our deposits, right? We'll be safe.
Yes, except that causes moral hazard. See, deposit insurance is what's interesting. And here in Baltimore, a lot of banking history has occurred here in Baltimore, a lot, which was also interesting to me because of my now connection to Baltimore. Deposit insurance does keep people safe. And people in Maryland will remember this from the SNL crisis when their savings weren't that safe with a state-funded program. But that's really a stepping stone. The real goal of deposit insurance is to calm the public enough that they don't run banks and cause them to collapse unnecessarily and then have that horrible contraction of credit. It's really a way to provide systemic, calmness to the system, and individuals benefit individually. But the real point of it is to stop runs.
Right, right. So in It's a Wonderful Life, when there was a run on the bank, the Bailey Savings and Loan.
Yeah, yeah.
That was before FDIC?
That was before. It's interesting you asked me that. Someone asked me that question, and I spent a lot of time looking it up. It's unclear, but yes, I believe it is. But I'd have to, if it wasn't that period, it was right around when it was being discussed. And the other really great thing that I learned, I guess I knew it because I had one line about it in the first book I wrote. And when rereading that book, I said, why didn't I make more of this? FDR was against deposit insurance.
I found that so interesting. He thought that if you had insured deposits, it would make depositors complacent or less vigilant about how the bank was run.
Absolutely. He was against it, and Hoover was for it, because Hoover was just going crazy with all the thousands of banks that were failing right at the end of his tenure. And he was trying to get Roosevelt to say something, and Roosevelt wouldn't, but except about deposit insurance. He said it will cause moral hazard, which it did. Consumers became indifferent. Now, you could also argue that realistically, before deposit insurance, people couldn't really be that vigilant about their banks because we didn't have any accounting standards, or there was no Securities and Exchange Commission. There were no public disclosures, and if there were, they weren't uniform. So the public would have a hard time really monitoring where they're putting their money. And even today, with all this disclosure, it's hard. You have to be an economist or really understand how to read sheets. But He was worried about that. And so what he demanded finally, FDR, in exchange for saying, okay, I'll go with deposit insurance, but to counter that indifference of depositors, we need tougher regulation. That is the bargain. We are going to oversee the deposit insurance funds, one for thrifts and one for commercial banks. Now they're the same. They've become merged. But we're going to do that to make sure that on behalf of taxpayers, on behalf of these taxpayer-backed funds. Yes, banks pay a premium into these insurance funds, but they're not really there for when the sun is shining. They're there for when there's a crisis to calm jitters. And when that happens, the premiums that banks have paid aren't enough. You really do have to have taxpayer backing. And during the thrift crisis, Reagan and Bush misused deposit insurance exactly as FDR was worried about. Because when Reagan and Bush came to office, Reagan as president, George H.W.
Vice president.
As vice president and then president. He was in charge. Some vice presidents don't do very much, but Bush did. He was in charge of sort of Reagan's financial problems and how to solve them. And the biggest problem, when Reagan came to office, a whole swath, you remember interest rates were going through the roof. Imagine having an interest rate of 21.5%. We now have people are earning nothing on their savings, but 21.5%. So when Reagan came to office, a whole swath of the savings and loan industry was insolvent and should have been closed. But a lot of them had supported Reagan, and many of the biggest ones were from California, his home state. So when he came in, he and Bush said, well, we promised no new taxes, so let's see if we can let them grow out of their problem. So we're going to hide the fact that they're insolvent with a lot of accounting tricks, these IOUs and all this. They called it, I don't know if I can say this on this, there's generally accepted accounting principles, GAAP. And they said, okay, we're going to do all these accounting tricks and call it RAP, regulatory accounting principles. And you can imagine what Wall Street called it. They go from GAAP to RAP to crap. They literally, people were quoted saying that. But they hid the problem. And I would go to my editors at the Post and I'd say, hey, there's this huge taxpayer liability. To close the thrifts that should have been closed when Reagan came to office, Reagan and Bush, that were through no fault of their own, it was just change that interest rates were soaring, technology was coming, they should have closed those and it would have cost taxpayers maybe $30 to $60 billion, that's the estimate. Not their fault, but they wouldn't do it because they were afraid that if they did that, people would blame them for it and it would be perceived as a tax. So instead, they kept them alive with this phony baloney accounting, which they could only do because people were calm thinking, oh, consumers aren't going to lose anything, right? I'd go to my editors and say, there's this huge taxpayer liability that's growing. It was 30 to 60, but by keeping these sick puppies, these zombies, they were called zombie banks, mm-hmm. keeping them open, that they got worse. They didn't grow out of their problem. That was the Kool-Aid. Oh, they'll grow out of their problem if they diversify. They morphed into what had been something not their fault to really a tremendous bad asset problem. It went from 30 to 60 billion to 500 billion. And that's on Reagan and Bush.
A bad asset.
Yeah. Okay. I better enunciate more. I guess it's my drive down 95.
But it was a bad ass problem in 1985, 86, right?
It was 500 billion. And that's 10 times what it would have been if they had just told the truth. Now, Democrats were complicit too in the House and Senate. But I still feel like looking back this many years later, Reagan and Bush were the keepers of the federal budget, and they were engaging in accounting tricks to really deceive the public. And so the public, it was only because of deposit insurance that people, in fact, the federal government coming into Maryland and Ohio were the first the first cracks in the system appeared very vividly. And, Paul Volcker was very worried about TV evening news showing people lined up to get their money out of their bank, like George Bailey's mm-hmm. situation.
And here it was the old court savings and loan.
Oh, and Jeffrey Levitt. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yes. Well, those, see, he's a symptom. He was a crook, and there were a lot of crooks. And a lot of people think that that's the story of the SNL problem. The crooks come in when a sickness, a contagion, a canker sore in the banking system is allowed to stay open. That's when the crooks come in.
They're opportunists.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, I want to push this up another 10 years from that crisis to the 90s in a period of deregulation when Clinton was president, and then to the fresh in everyone's memory recession, of 2007, 2008. Severe recession of housing banking bust. Okay, so I have a quote here from Alan Greenspan, who's then chairman of the Federal Reserve, and had been a fierce supporter of deregulation. He appeared before Congress after this meltdown and seemed still bewildered by it, didn't understand it.
Well, where do you think you made a mistake then?
I made a mistake in presuming that the self-interest of organizations, specifically banks and others, were such as that they were best capable of protecting their own shareholders and the equity in the firms.
He believed that in a free market, certainly banks would act responsibly, commercial banks, and I mean investment banks in particular, would act responsibly because they don't want to melt down, they don't want to collapse.
But in fact, they had an incentive to, and I sometimes begin my classes telling my students, I'll show you how the investment banks put themselves out of business. Because they're publicly traded corporations, they have a short-term view. And there was, can I borrow this? I have to write it down or I never remember. I'll be gone, you'll be gone. On Wall Street, people say, IBG, YBG. I'll be gone, you'll be gone. So let's just do this. We don't care if the long-term effect is catastrophic.
Right.
We'll just do it. So Greenspan really didn't understand that. And he always wanted to come in after the fact and bail the industry out with lowering interest rates or whatever, but he never wanted to go in prophylactically, which is what you needed. And his idea, he was so radical that he even thought that that regulators should not be policing for fraud.
And it's been my experience that the loan officers of those institutions knew far more about the risks involved and the people to whom they lent money than I saw even our best regulators at the Fed capable of doing. So the problem here is something which looked to be a very solid edifice and indeed a critical pillar to market competition and free markets did break down, and I think that, as I said, shocked me. I still do not fully understand why it happened, and obviously to the extent that I figure out where it happened and why, I will change my views. If the facts change, I will change.
You had an idea.
So again, I'm pushing back in this book against this idea that we should grant incorporations, provide deposit insurance, and that there's no government role. There's some things only governments can do. You can't have incorporations without government. You can't have deposit insurance that works without a federal government. You can't have intellectual property protection without a government. And only the government can really prosecute fraud. You don't want mobs in the street doing it. By the way, Baltimore has a very colorful history of mob violence.
Right.
But you don't want that.
Right.
There are some things only government can do. You know, like every American, it's in our DNA. We don't want unnecessarily big government. We don't like government waste. Everyone agrees with that. But there are some things only government can do. And Greenspan was blinded by his ideology.
You had the authority to prevent irresponsible lending practices that led to the subprime mortgage crisis. You were advised to do so by many others. And now our whole economy is paying its price. Do you feel that your ideology pushed you to make decisions that you wish you had not made?
Well, remember that what an ideology is a conceptual framework with the way people deal with reality. Everyone has one. You have to exist, you need an ideology. The question is whether it is accurate or not. And what I'm saying to you is, yes, I found a flaw. I don't know how significant or permanent it is, but I've been very distressed by that fact.
A flaw
in the model that I perceived is the critical functioning structure that defines how the world works, so to speak.
In other words, you found that your view of the world, your ideology, was not right. It was not working.
That's precisely the reason I was shocked, because I've been going for 40 years or more with very considerable evidence that it was working exceptionally well.
I mean, he was immensely impractical, and it cost the economy. I mean, the savings and loan crisis cost taxpayers $500 billion. It was the biggest bailout up until that point. It is still the costliest. The most recent meltdown, Some of the tabulations were that taxpayer money was either used or potentially going to be used up to $24 trillion. Now, that didn't happen. I know, $24 trillion with a T, because the money was either paid back or was never tapped into. So that was the biggest bailout, but the costliest remains the SNL. The other thing that really became clear to me several years later of the SNL crisis, the most lasting effect of it was not just the bailout, but was that's when deregulation occurred in financial services. Reagan and Bush were deregulating these sick zombie banks to make them enticing to everyone else in the financial sector who wanted to buy a bank and couldn't buy a commercial bank. So instead they bought these zombie banks and did what they wanted to do in deregulation. So that's when it happened. And I called stealth deregulation because there weren't really the public hearings. We didn't really talk about it as a policy.
But you get to Rubin and Larry Summers and in the Clinton years, right?
Yes. Yeah. And by then they had been infected with this idea that governments are bad and governments don't do any good, even though Clinton did actually think government could be used for good. So it was this kind of muddled idea. Greenspan used to drive me crazy. He would always go on the Hill and say, let's not have regulations for regulation's sake. Well, who ever said that? Sure. Let's just slap some rules on there, you know? It was ridiculous. And so he dropped the ball. He broke the bargain. He was supposed to be there on behalf of taxpayers, making sure that these institutions who have this privilege of being incorporated, of being a bank, and have deposit insurance, aren't doing things that are against the public's interest.
So if you bail out the big banks, if you avert catastrophe that way, or make it not as severe,
right?
If they're protected against losses in the future, why shouldn't they be expected to act irresponsibly again?
Well, they will. That's the bailout causes moral hazard for executives. Because, you know, think about it. If you went down, we can almost see the casino from here, right, off of I-95. Mm-hmm. If I told you, you could go there and gamble all day, and if you win something, you get to keep it. But if you lose, I'll reimburse you. You'd stand up, walk out of this interview, and go gamble all day long, right? Well, bailing out has that effect. Now, you have to do it. You have to hold your nose and do it to prevent, as you said, a worse meltdown. You want to kind of short-circuit it and at least stop it from getting worse. Everyone always likens this to the smoker. This is what people like to say. Okay, if someone smokes in bed and sets his house on fire, you don't let the whole neighborhood burn down just because that person was there. You got to go in and do it. Yeah, but you know what? You ought to prosecute the guys who was smoking in bed, and that's what doesn't happen. So the joke, kind of a macabre joke, is that it's not just too big to fail, they were too big to jail.
So given that, and that's something a lot of Americans are aware of.
Yeah, and mad about.
And mad about. What's to keep it from happening again?
Nothing, except that we need to get regulators to do their job. And now there are some, there is a banker who is head of BB&T, a big regional successful bank, who's like mine with Koch Brothers. And he has suggested that we get rid of the deposit insurance and the regulation. And why I don't endorse that, at least he's consistent. Mm-hmm. Why should we have the deposit insurance and all these regulators and they don't do their job? So maybe we should get rid of both. That's unlikely to happen. Voters wouldn't go for that, I don't think, getting rid of deposit insurance. People really like it. They don't even realize how much they like it.
But get them to do their job.
So get them to do their job.
You pointed out in the book that regulators at the Federal Reserve don't seem to be doing their job.
Oh, it's worse than that. Under this administration, one of the top banking regulators, the mouthful, the controller of the currency, but he's within Treasury, he calls banks that he's supposed to be supervising his customers. That's so wrong-headed and wrong. It's just wrong. And that's the kind of thinking. And they're doing a lot of things in this administration that are reintroducing practices and policies that help lead to the last meltdown.
May I just say, it just seems to me like there's a rollback from Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank's under attack.
Yeah.
Mick Mulvaney took over the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and pretty much has neutered it. And this is something that only went into place within the last 6 or 7 years, right?
Right. One of the big mistakes at the end of the mortgage meltdown, everyone was trying to spark credit. So, you know, Bush Jr. and Obama, Larry Summers, everyone was trying to get credit going. People didn't need more credit. They needed less debt. And so because consumers account, people don't realize this, for 60 to 70 cents of every dollar spent in the in the economy comes from rank and file consumers. So if you hobble them with too much debt, you're torpedoing the economy. So the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was put in place in recognition that we need to make sure that consumers aren't fleeced with unsound practices. So one of the practices that was put in place with Dodd-Frank for mortgage lending, and it's kind of, it makes me laugh every time I say this because it's ridiculous, you have to put this into law, is that before you make give someone a home loan, you have to make sure they can there's a chance they can repay it, right?
No, I came across those words in your book and I said, really? Yes, we had to put that in writing.
We had to codify it. It's ridiculous. And so what that person has done, and also bank regulators, they've rolled that back. It's called the ability to pay standard. And so, of course, even if you underwrite and are pretty sure someone can repay, sometimes they'll still default, but you lower your default rate by looking, can this person afford this loan? They are now telling payday lenders, you don't have to see whether someone can afford their loan. And guess what? Some of you home loan lenders, you don't have to either. They're going right back to these completely ridiculous, my kids know better. It's just common sense.
Why does Wells Fargo still exist?
Well, that's a good question.
I mean, when I go through the litany of offenses and fines that they've paid for these offenses because they have been caught. You know, this goes back to the subprime problem here in Baltimore was fierce in other cities with Wells Fargo. They got their customers, unapproved accounts for their customers. That was another thing. And then they got auto insurance that people didn't need.
This is why it's so ridiculous. These huge institutions, and they're very complicated too. They're not just big, but complicated. So they silo all their different divisions, which is ridiculous, so that they don't see their own systemic risk. So the government comes in and they realize that Wells Fargo, this even angered people who are for deregulation, opened, you know, thousands of accounts for people who never asked for them. So they get wrapped on the knuckle and they pay a fine. Then it turns out they didn't bother to look whether they were doing it elsewhere. They were giving people auto insurance they hadn't asked for. And then when people missed their payments, they were repossessed and they were going after them. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It's crazy. It all goes back to this. I always have to look at it. IBG, YBG. This is a phrase people use on Wall Street.
I'll be gone, you'll be gone.
I'll be gone, you'll be gone. So I'm looking at my short term. If I can meet my quarterly targets, I'll get my bonus. I'll get my whatever. And if it leads to disaster, it will be on someone else's watch.
Why don't we learn about boom to bust? Why is it always, I mean, booms are great. I guess everyone loves a boom. But why do we go to the other extreme?
You want healthy booms. So this book is not about normal credit cycles. We always banks lend a little too long and then they are a little slow to get back in the game.
No, this is about
this is about people who don't start out crookedly, by the way, but skate. I heard someone from one of the big investment banks say this once from Merrill Lynch, where you're just skating really close to the edge. And, of course, the more you do that, eventually someone skates over the edge. And it happens over and over again because people forget. They lose their institutional memory. And it seems like it's a good thing now. And no one wants to upset the apple cart when people are making a lot of money selling apples. And even though the apples contain poison, I'm going to probably make this an analogy that won't be unsustainable.
But it's
unsustainable when you get these. It was so ridiculous what caused it. And so one of the things, like the conclusion I come to, and this was good for the editors of the book, they made me think, like really think, like what would remedy this? And I hate to say it because everyone comes up with this, is the only real remedy is campaign finance reform. Because the financial industry is the most well-heeled lobby bar none. Let me see if I can remember these statistics. I looked them up from something called Open Secrets, which is a nonprofit that just collects campaign finance data. And in the 1990 through 2000, in this 20-year period, just federal donations, so this is not dark money or all the other ways you can find loopholes to give, these five industries didn't give as much as the financial industry by itself. So if you took transportation, healthcare, agribusiness, oil and electronics, these five huge industries didn't give as much in campaign contributions in just that one category as the financial services industry does. So it's one-stop campaign contribution place. People love to be on the House and Senate banking committees. Mm-hmm. The House is called Financial Services Committee. They love to be on those because it's so easy to raise money. It's so much easier. So this industry, basically, if you go and watch hearings at these committees, it's like it could be a Woody Allen movie with bubbles over each elected official's head. Oh, he represents investment banks. This person's representing insurance. It's not serving the American public very well. We could have better conversations, more honest, more thoughtful, obviously, and more productive about how we should regulate and how we should not, on occasion, financial services if campaign contributions were not the picture.
We'll have more conversation with Kathleen Day, author of Broken Bargain, Bankers, Bailouts, and the Struggle to Tame Wall Street, after a couple of messages.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
Hey, listeners, during the run of the 2019 Maryland General Assembly session, you can get updates on news from Annapolis on the Roughly Speaking Government Edition. Sun reporter Luke Broadwater and Malia Cromer, director of the Goucher Poll at Goucher College, are teaming up to file reports. So be listening for the government edition of Roughly Speaking each week until the end of the Maryland legislative session.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by United Way. From housing and education to healthcare and employment, they will help you fight to make the biggest difference in your community. Join the fight at uwcm.org/fight.
So what about going back to Glass-Steagall as it was after the Great Depression, to separate them, commercial banking from investment banking? I mean, why not go back to that?
You could, if you talk about regulation or deregulation. You're talking about the rules and the oversight. So if you're going to have more rules, you don't need as much oversight because people aren't doing as many complicated things. But I think the genie's out of the bottle, or is not the bottle. It's a
the lamp.
The lamp. The genie's out of the lamp. We could put it back, and maybe we should. It's one way to go. But I would argue it wasn't deregulation per se that caused the problem. It was lack of oversight, that the regulators, again, didn't do their job. And Greenspan is Exhibit A, someone who didn't even understand his job. For him to say that the markets should police themselves for fraud, that's ridiculous. Should we police ourselves to enforce copyright rules? Government is needed. You can't have incorporations. You can't have a bank. You can't have deposit insurance without the government. The question is how to get the government to do its job. They shouldn't just be handing out the candy. They should be making sure that people aren't getting diabetes from eating too much of it.
I'll take that metaphor. I like that. Did that get in your book?
No.
Oh, maybe the second edition.
Maybe the second edition. That's really what the issue is here.
What does the term non-prime mean? Is this something we're going to be hearing more about?
Oh, they're trying to invent new ways. What you're really going to be hearing more about, it's really just subprime. It just means people with dented credit. And they've been in the market for a long time. And there's a way to serve people with dented credit without ripping them off and making them, without drowning them. I mean, it's ridiculous. But the phrases you're going to hear as an excuse for these bad practices by, you don't have to see if a person can afford this loan. Just give them a loan. It's all these buzz phrases, like giving people more access to credit, giving consumers choice. And it's a lot of malarkey. It really is. We heard those same phrases when the mortgage industry and the investment banking industry drove themselves and millions of consumers into financial ruin.
Are we in some danger here? I mean, I read different stories, different forecasts, prognostications from economists about the way this economy is going and what could be up ahead. From your end of it, looking at regulation and oversight, do you see a problem looming?
I do. I think there are real cracks in the system. Far be it for me to say what the next crisis will be, but there are dangerous signs. There's too much lending to really over-leveraged companies. So there's that. There's this huge market to lend money to companies that are already over-leveraged, and they often use the money for not good purposes. They buy back their stock, or they're paying dividends with borrowed money, which basically makes the executives look good under the IBG, YBG. I'll be gone, you'll be gone, let's buy back the stock, make ourselves look better, get our bonuses and go. But the equally troubling to me, if you take the overview of what this administration is doing to gut consumer protections, I think it's a real problem. They're listening to Wall Street, which would like to jettison what's called the fiduciary rule. So fiduciary, if you go to an advisor and they're a fiduciary, they have to do what's in your best interest, even if it costs them money. They want to switch to what sounds really nice, a suitability rule. Well, what that means, if I'm an advisor to you and I only have to consider suitability, it means that I only can put you in things that are appropriate for your risk appetite. So I can't put you in penny stocks if you're really conservative. But after that, if I have two mutual funds, and one of the mutual funds, they're about equal risk, but one is going to pay me some money legally.
The advisor.
I'm going to get a kickback from them.
Right.
It's called a 12b1. If they pay me this legal kickback, and it means that you'll get less money going into this one, I'm free to steer you to that one. It's ridiculous. So they're gutting the fiduciary rule. They're trying to. And Trump and the Republicans in Congress, and this really is on them, they killed a fiduciary rule that Obama was trying to put in for retirees. Companies, publicly traded companies, have an obligation if they have employees with a 401k, when those employees are about to retire, to give them a little help on thinking about where to put their money. Because once you retire, you have to take your money out of that 401k and put it elsewhere. Now, if you're at Vanguard or something, you can stay right in Vanguard. They just put it a different account. They don't call it your employer account anymore. But you're supposed to get a little advice. The advice was getting such that the advisors are Wall Street, and they were beginning to steer people into their own products, not necessarily the best products. So a very common sense rule that they had to act as fiduciary, you would have thought people had, you know, shot their mothers. They went and said, that's ridiculous, we shouldn't have to be fiduciaries, and they were reduced in court to saying, we're not really giving advice, we're marketing. Well, that's the point. If you're marketing, you shouldn't hold us to the fiduciary duty.
Right.
It's such a circuitous argument, because you're not really giving the advice you should. So, they're lowering the capital standards under this regime. Oh, they're giving. Here's one. The guy, the regulator who called the banks his customers, has proposed and unveiled a new corporate federal charter, that would be issued for non-bank banks. First of all, when you hear the phrase non-bank banks, there's a whole history to that. That's a big red flag. But what he's doing is he's offering lenders who don't take deposits but lend money. He's saying, we're going to give you a federal charter so you can ignore state consumer protection law. You can't make this up. And that was one of the things that led to the mortgage crisis, is the same agency that he now heads told state bank regulators and consumer protection regulators, attorneys general in all 50 states, you can't enforce your consumer protection laws when it comes to national banks. So buzz off. In the book, I say they told them to shut up and sit down. And they're doing it again. There's no reason to have that federal charter except to bypass state law.
Kathleen Day is a longtime journalist, now on the faculty of the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School. Her book, published earlier this year by Yale University Press, is Broken Bargain: Bankers, Bailouts, and the Struggle to Tame Wall Street. I'm Dan Rodericks at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to this episode of Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.